Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the so-called sequestration or trigger that has now been pulled to cut $1.2 trillion in federal spending across the board. We will speak with Nicole Wu, the Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, about these proposed cuts, $600 billion of which will come out of discretionary spending that was already cut recently by $900 billion. Then we will examine whether or not the Pentagon will take a hit from the automatic budget cuts that are currently in place but will not come into effect for a year. Pentagon watchdog Dina Racer, the chief investigator for the Follow the Money project, joins us to discuss the likelihood of the cuts being renegotiated and the hysterical overreaction by defense hawks to the proposed cuts that, if enacted, would still leave us with a military budget higher than Cold War levels when we actually had a real enemy. Then finally, we will talk with Bob Ostertag, who is Professor of Technocultural Studies and Music at UC Davis, where some of his students were recently pepper sprayed by police, widely seen in video that has gone viral, provoking outrage around the world. We will discuss how such an overreaction was justified by campus authorities and why UC police are so heavily armed, while police at private universities are mostly unarmed. Joining us now is Nicole Wu, the Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. She has worked on domestic hunger policy as the Associate Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and as a Senior Policy Analyst at the Food Research and Action Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicole Wu.
Thank you. Hello.
And do you think that this trigger is real? I mean, the president has said that he will veto any attempt to circumvent it by the Congress, but it doesn't come into effect for a year, and most of the punditry seems to think that the Congress are going to sort of wiggle and weasel their way around it. So give us a sense of, on the one hand, the president trying to use his veto leverage is to keep them honest, and on the other hand, the expectation that they'll find a way to get out of it.
I think we're reading tea leaves here. I remember when this first passed, the supercommittee was first set up over the summer, and they set up these triggers, and I think the sense was that these types of cuts for defense and non-defense discretionary spending would be harsh enough to force the supercommittee to come to some sort of a deal. So I do think that there is a sense that something needs to be done and that the president really does want to have some sort of deficit reduction. I think the nuances have been lost in the entire debate about the timing of deficit reduction. In an economy with a high unemployment rate as we have now, it's probably not the best time to do it. But it's really hard to tell whether or not Congress is going to try to pass some laws to undo what they agreed to do last summer.
But Nicole Wu, all of the deficit reduction plans profit so far, including one that the president himself set up, the Simpson-Bowles Commission, they asked for much, much greater cuts than the $1.2 trillion. This would suggest, in a way, that it's extraordinary to think that we've had, for the last couple of years, so much of this bludgeoning in the press, this mantra of that the country's going broke, we're like Greece, et cetera, et cetera. But for all of the rhetoric, mostly coming from the Republicans, at the end of the day, they seem incapable of making cuts unless they come out of social programs.
I think there's a few things going on. One is that our economy is not like Greece. We're in a much stronger position, and the deficits that we have now are large, but they're not the main problem in our economy. Right now, the main problem is unemployment and the lack of jobs, and the supercommittee and deficit reduction is a real distraction from the real problems with middle class Americans are facing. Another thing to remember about the deficit deals that have been kind of cobbled together and talked about, the Simpson-Bowles plan and some of the other plans, is that they all had significant revenue increases in them. They raised taxes. And if you look back even further to the grand bargains that happened in the 1980s and the 1990s, they all included, actually, usually mostly taxes and less spending cuts. Under Reagan, most of his plans were mostly tax increases. He raised taxes many times. So part of what's going on here is that in the past, bipartisan deficit deals included both tax increases and spending cuts. As we've seen in the past year, positions have hardened, that the Republicans have been less willing to agree to any tax increases. And that seems to be part of what's going on here.
So this particular episode now in failed deficit reduction, that this was came out of the economic hostage crisis where the Republican House threatened to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they didn't get their way, bringing about a threat of a default, which took us down to the wire, as we all recall, and out of that came a bill that then set up this super committee. But at the time, as you pointed out, Nicole Wu, $900 billion was already cut in terms of discretionary spending, and the $1.2 trillion that they failed to come to an agreement on would have included an additional $600 billion in discretionary cuts. What's left to cut? Because discretionary spending is a very, very small fraction of the overall budget, isn't it?
It's not the largest part of the budget. And unfortunately, it does seem to be getting hit with the cuts most often, probably because it's called discretionary spending, and people don't really know what that is. In the original cuts, mandatory programs, which include things like Social Security, Medicare, food stamps, were not included in the cuts. And in the coming cuts, most mandatory programs are exempt, although Medicare will be facing some decreases in payments to providers and insurance plans, and some other mandatory programs such as farm price supports will also be subject to some cuts. But again, most of the cuts are going to programs such as roads, education, medical research, scientific research, basically investments in our future. So we might be saving some money now. But, you know, these cuts will have some really major effects in the future. And another thing I'd like to point out is that in the past, the debt ceiling increases were passed in a bipartisan way. As a routine matter, our country seems to be the only one that has a debt ceiling. So this summer, the agreement that they came to was that there would be a dollar of cuts or a dollar of deficit reduction for every dollar increase in the debt ceiling, regardless of what the state of the economy is right now. And so this is a continuation of that deal. You know, the part of this super committee that hasn't been highlighted is that this is all in exchange for raising the debt ceiling, kind of dollar per dollar, which is what the Republicans were demanding in order to sign off on the deal.
But I recall back then, back in the summer, when the negotiations were going on, there was a lot of disquiet on the part of progressives that the Democrats were far too accommodating and that the cuts ratio were 9-1 in favor of the Republicans, who were being absolutely inflexible over taxes. I recall also, for example, that things like corporate jets, subsidies, and subsidies to oil companies making record profits were also brought up. So give us a sense about this debate in Washington between left-wing welfare and right-wing welfare. Who's got the upper hand?
I think right now they're at a bit of a stalemate. Most of the entitlement programs, such as Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, have been protected through the efforts of groups trying to protect the interests of retirees and people who, you know, need their health care. On the other side, we do have the Grover Norquist here in Washington, D.C., who are demanding that Republicans not sign on to any tax increases. So at this point, those two sides are kind of at a stalemate. The groups in the middle, or more, I guess, to the left, trying to defend the discretionary spending are the ones who are losing. And again, that's a lot of programs, you know, housing assistance, education, you know, some job training, low-income assistance programs, and then also, as I said before, you know, important research infrastructure. They don't have as strong of a constituency or as unified of a voice. And so they're the ones who are just getting hit over and over. They got hit by $900 billion, as you said, over the summer, and they're going to face another $600 billion now due to the super committee not coming to a deal. And most of that spending, I would say, affects the 99%, not the 1%. And, you know, if there is going to be true shared sacrifice, it seems that it would make sense for the 1% to do some of the heavy lifting and to contribute to the reduction of the deficit.
So in terms of what I refer to, Nicole, we're with right-wing welfare, for example, agribusiness, the enormous farm subsidies that largely go to agribusiness, and you being a specialist on domestic hunger policy, obviously know about the Department of Agriculture, and the tax breaks to oil companies, et cetera, who are making record profits. None of that's on the table, not in terms of what's being discussed.
Actually, some farm price supports are going to be cut according to what was in the Budget Control Act this summer. So now that the Super Committee has not come to a deal, there will be about $5 billion in cuts from farm price supports. But, you know, Medicare payments to providers and insurance plans will be cut by about $10 billion. So, you know, relatively, corporate welfare is not being touched. As you said, the corporate jets and the oil subsidies are not being touched.
And what about the Defense Department? What, they're the ones that are howling. We're spending more on defense than the rest of the world combined, and more than we ever have since World War II.
Right. Well, the Defense Department will be hit with, you know, half of the cuts coming out of the Super Committee failing to come to a deal. I'm not a defense analyst, so I hear that you're going to have someone who knows a lot more than I do. But it's about 15% of defense spending, and you know, I think we all know that the defense budget has grown massively over the last 10 years, more than 50%. So you know, a 15% cut over 10 years after growth of 50%. It seems like it should be doable, but again, I'm not a defense budget analyst, so I'm.
But what about Homeland Security, which came out of the 9/11 and the spike in defense spending? It's not a part of the defense budget, but it's still about $1 trillion that's been spent so far. And Homeland Security itself doesn't really know what it's spending its money on, and that explains why we have these kind of Star Wars type. Cops out there with pepper spray because they have all these toys and stuff that the taxpayer pays for, which they then pass on to local police forces. So in terms of those kind of spending, Department of Energy, the nuclear weapons and all that stuff, is that anything going to happen with that?
It depends on, you know, where it lands in the budget lines. I'm not sure exactly which programs you're talking about. Whether or not they land under defense or discretionary or non-defense discretionary, like Department of Energy, I'm not sure if they all fall under non-defense discretionary or not.
Mm-hmm. And Homeland Security, we don't know quite where that stands, right?
It depends on whether or not it's defense or whether or not it's security spending, and I'm pretty sure it says defense, which usually does not include Homeland Security. So that would be under the other discretionary programs.
So, Nicole, the real question, though, is to ask here is this real or not? And as I say, a lot of people don't think it is. The president has threatened to veto any efforts to sort of weasel out of it. I suspect he's doing that because that's the only leverage he has to keep their feet to the fire and keep them honest. What's your take on this?
It really is tea leaf reading. The president has said not that he is going to hold their feet to the fire for exactly the cuts that were in the super committee, you know, in the Budget Control Act this summer, but that he will not sign any bill that doesn't have the same amount of deficit reduction as, you know, the $1.2 trillion that we're going to have automatically if nothing's done. So he's leaving the door open to different ways to get to that goal of $1.2 trillion between now and 2021. And we'll see. It seems difficult to imagine anyone passing a bill that would add to the deficit. during an election year. But we've seen stranger things happen here in Washington, D.C. There does seem to be, concern on both sides of the aisle to address the deficit. A better deal, I think, from the progressive point of view, would be for a deal to have infrastructure and job creation proposals happening very soon while unemployment is very high. Things to create jobs, maybe rebuild some roads, have the payroll tax cuts, extend unemployment insurance, things to get the economy back on track. And then later on, maybe over that, 9-10 year frame, then to address deficit reduction. We'll have a stronger economy at that point, and we won't be hurting people. And in many ways, I would have much preferred if we had a jobs trigger or an unemployment rate trigger rather than a deficit trigger. That would make a lot more sense for the health of the economy and the way regular Americans are affected.
Well, a lot of what you just listed there, Nicole, were the president's already proposed, and that it's been filibustered to death in the Senate, and we don't know what's going to happen with the payroll tax expiring. I mean, that seems to be a fairly incendiary political issue, isn't it? Because that's clearly another one of these stark reminders of who supports the 1%, the Republicans, and that's the payroll tax is definitely something that the 99%ers have. They'll feel the pain, right?
Yeah, it is puzzling that Republicans are not liking a tax cut. They generally do enjoy them, and as you said, it might have to do with the fact that it's the large swath of working Americans that are affected by this. The payroll tax cut is, your Social Security taxes, which are capped at $106,000 and $800,000 of income. So the super wealthy actually pay a lower rate overall in the payroll tax cut. So this cut, does affect, most working Americans. It's, about $1,000 for the average household. And it's extra money to go into the economy. The super wealthy probably don't need it. It doesn't make a huge difference to them. The one thing that might be changing the calculus are things like the Occupy Wall Street movement, the 1% versus the 99% that the media has picked up on. We'll see. The polling shows that the vast majority of Americans, support some tax increases, especially tax increases on the wealthy. We'll see if the politicians and, the members of Congress and the president and, the Republican candidate for president will be picking up on these polls and the opinions of the American people. It's very hard to predict. It'll be an interesting year next year.
Well, just in closing, though, there's one thing that I think we don't have to predict, just based upon the recent performance of the Congress, where something that you've worked in the past, food policy, showed the sort of ugly hand of lobbying, where the lobbyists in the Senate and the House managed to pressure the Department of Agriculture in terms of its food policy, and they have managed to have pizza in school lunches classified as a vegetable. And rather than cut back on French fries and substitute French fries with salads and fruit, the lobbyists stepped in and protected the potato lobby, and they protected the frozen food lobby. That seems to me to be what Washington is more and more about. And I think with 9% approval and after this failure to come to an agreement, God knows what the percentage of support will be. What's your sense, just in the last second here, of what's really going on in Washington?
Washington has become a very polarized place. The most people or members of Congress, I think, are forced into rather extreme positions. And, we also have a lot of campaign donations which affect their decisions. It's never quite been this way. I've been here for quite a while, since the Clinton years, and, I do remember bipartisan deficit and debt deals, bipartisan bills passing, where people crossed the aisle to pass legislation that was needed. And the last few years have just been complete deadlock, pretty much. We'll see what the voters do in 2012 if they decide that they want to change things up and have some members who are more likely to compromise. The primary system doesn't really lead to that, but we'll see what happens.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Nicole Wu.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicole Wu, who's the Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. She's worked on domestic hunger policy as the Associate Director of the New York City Coalition Against Hunger and as a Senior Policy Analyst for the Food Research and Action Center. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the Pentagon watchdog about whether or not the Pentagon will take a hit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dina Racer, who is the chief investigator of the Follow the Money Project, with over 25 years of experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud. For 10 years, Dina Racer directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that she founded. And in its work with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and defense industry, they work to expose fraud and waste. Ms. Racer authored The Pentagon Underground and co-authored Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. Her latest article at Truthout is Should Cost Versus Did Cost, How the Military-Industrial Complex Swindles Billions of Our Dollars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dina Racer.
Thank you very much.
And so
I'd like to mention that I have a column at truthout.org.
Oh, you have a column. Okay.
A weekly column comes out every Thursday called Making Government Work. And I've been doing a lot of Pentagon stuff because it's not working.
Well, the real question is, and I'm still sort of trying to get an answer here, on whether this sequestration is for real. A lot of people think that years before it comes into effect, it's currently the law, I guess, but it's not going to come into effect for a year, that they'll be able to weasel out of it. The president has said he'd veto any changes that they try to make, and is obviously using that as leverage to force them to come to the deal that they couldn't come to. What's your understanding of this?
Well, I don't, you know, I was not very hopeful at all until Obama said, I will veto if you try to, you know, wiggle out of this with the automatic savings. And, you know, purposely the Democrats put in that the Pentagon would get a big hit, so there would be pain on all sides. I do think that, the Pentagon's going to have to cut some. There's no way they're going to get off scot-free. Whether it's the $600 billion, I don't know. I do think that he is trying to, you know, play a game of chicken. Meanwhile, it's very curious that his Secretary of Defense, who used to be known as the tough OMB cutter of the budget in the past, in the 1990s, is suddenly become the biggest cheerleader for the military-industrial complex. And Leon Panetta really kind of disappointed me because I thought, oh, here's somebody who knows how to cut. So it's not clear, but what people have to understand, and this is the key, and this is one fact that you keep in your mind, all they're asking, even if you do the $600 billion worth of cuts over 10 years, is to go back to defense spending levels in constant dollars of 2007. And in 2007, we were still spending in constant dollars more money on defense than the Cold War, the Vietnam War, every war except World War II. So in 2007, we were spending more money on defense. And this is not counting the money that we spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, which they always do in supplementals. So just the base budget of the Pentagon is after those cuts that they're screaming about like stuck pigs would still take them back to a level where there is more defense spending than any other time except for World War II.
And Dina Reiser, prior to this sequestration acts coming down, Panetta had promised to cut $400 billion out of the Pentagon. Where do we stand on that?
Well, I think what they did, they kind of did the easy low-hanging fruit on that, and that is they counted as cuts getting out of Iraq and winding down in Afghanistan. So they counted the war cuts, which de-escalation of money as part of these quote savings, even though everybody knew it was going to happen anyway.
And is that, but these, you know, Iraq wasn't paid for, it was off the books. So how could they count in the withdrawal from Iraq and the drawdown in Afghanistan?
They just counted that when they don't want to, you know, count in the wars, they don't count them. When they do want to count in the wars,
I see.
When you count them, it's, you know, this is all
budget manipulation. Wouldn't it be great if we all had accountants like that and that the IRS would accept their word? I mean, this is unbelievable, isn't it?
It is, and you know, I'm actually sitting down now, working on my column tonight, and looking at all the statistics of where we are. And it just came out yesterday that there was a law passed in 1999, the Clinton administration, saying all government departments have to pass a fiscal audit, the same way that companies have to pass a fiscal audit. And it took a while, but every single department has passed except DOD. And it just came out again that DOD failed. 23 out of 24 departments, and DOD failed the audit again. And earlier in September, they were trying to be very hopeful that they're going to pass it on it by 2017, you know. And first it was 2024, then they dropped it to 2017 when people, you know, just were saying. And now to sort of massage and try to get control, you know, get people to, in Congress and everybody to look at it, they say, well, maybe we're going to try now for, like, you know, 2014, maybe 2013, 2014. And it's just they've spent billions on accounting things. Each service buys their own software, has their own program. They don't talk to each other. It's a monumental disaster. And the excuse OMB gave of why the Pentagon's not doing it is because the Pentagon is very large and complex and all that. But, hey, so is the Department of Human Health and Human Services, who, you know, do all of Medicare and Social Security and everybody else, and they passed an audit, so they know where their money is. So the question comes down to, how are we going to know what to cut if we don't know what they have?
And nobody's asking that question.
Well, I am on my column.
I know, but I mean, the super committee, the president, Panetta, have you heard it from anybody at that level?
No, I mean, I have to admit that having talked to the director of you see my column that I wrote, director of defense pricing, Shay Assad, has, you know, claimed he's going to try to get control. They're making the right sounds and they're making the right things, but, you know, I kind of just sit back after 30 years and they claim they're going to do all this stuff to make it work, and I thought, well, yeah, you know, you're going to be walking into that buzzsaw. And so I think the administration is probably, you know, they canceled the F-22. We didn't think that could happen. So this administration has shown, you know, a willingness to do it more than most. The Congress, however, is, you know, so porked out on defense that's sort of an equal opportunity. Both there are obviously Democrats who want to cut, but an awful lot of them want to cut as long as it's not in their district.
So in terms of this, the hit that the Pentagon would take from the sequestration, and you mentioned that the Democrats put it in and they made sure that Social Security and Medicare weren't hit, but the Pentagon was, is that therefore a victory for progressives and Democrats?
Well, or? I mean, if I didn't think so when they all, you know, the House, the Republican on the House Armed Services Committee, the chairman, you know, within a day after this all fell apart, immediately put in a law saying, we don't have to do it. And then Obama came up with his, he said, no, you have to do the law as passed. You can't, he said, if you try to change it, I'll veto it. And I was really smart. I was really surprised. I didn't think that, I thought he'd say, well, we can change it or it has to be the same amount, but we'll change where we cut. And no, he's basically saying you can't get rid of the consequences. So there may be some deal worked out, but that was hopeful. I'm not usually surprised by what goes on in Washington, but that was a surprise.
But the president's, I assume that the president's basically, he can't very well give up his leverage, can he? He can't say, well, we're going to move on. I mean, he's got to hold their feet to the fire. Is it, and the fact that his own Secretary of Defense is saying that these cuts are irresponsible would suggest to me that...
Yeah, I don't quite get why Panetta's being allowed to say that if indeed he wants to go ahead, Obama wants to go ahead and cut the Defense Department. Of course, everyone's talking about cutting the military pensions, not the weapon systems, not the Holy Grail weapon systems, but now let's go after the people and the training. That's the first place they always try to cut, logistics and people.
The boys, not the toys.
Yeah, that's right, and the toys are... We are buying less and less and less weapons for more and more and more price. And, you know, I guess if you're a total and complete peacenik and you don't care where the money, that we waste a lot of money, you could say we're going to eventually spend ourselves into unilateral disarmament. Right. One airplane shared by all three services, because every generation of weapon is based on all the fraud, waste, and fat of the previous generation. And so they are monumentally overpriced.
Yeah, so this is, it used to be said that, you know, that we could get by with a Timex, not a Rolex, but this is a Rolex studded with jewels to the point where...
no, they don't work in the battlefield. You know,
right.
You may have something, or they end up, you know, we're still building things that are based on Cold War mentality. The Pentagon doesn't change much, you know. It's like a freight train.
But the people in control are not. They're the contractors. Clearly, if they're the ones that win in these budget battles, and if the and I noticed in the Republican debate, and as we speak, of course, the Republicans are debating again on national security. Last time around, I think it was Bachman suggested that they should look at TRICARE and make cuts out of TRICARE, which is you'd think would be a sacred cow amongst the military people, their own healthcare system.
Yeah, well, you know, and the other part about it is that the Pentagon bureaucracy rolls on year after year. But, you know, they know that the political appointees come and go, and they just kind of, you know, give them mushroom treatment, feed them manure, and keep them in the dark, if they call it.
Right.
So a lot of these civilian people who come in, oh, I'm going to reform, and they're, you know, they think they're pulling all these levers, and the levers aren't going anywhere.
Right.
You know? So it's very frustrating. I mean, I have seen more promise in this administration towards actually making reforms. There's been some very good whistleblower stuff done. There's been some very good. They canceled some weapons that I never thought they'd cancel, the F-22. The problem is that you have to get at two things, and one is the military industrial complex. The contractors and the Pentagon will always be joined at the hip as long as you have that kind of revolving door where they go work for the contractor, you know, then they come back in the military, or they've been in the military, they go work the contractor, then they come back the military as a civilian, then go work for another contractor, and they don't see the lines. I mean, the lines are blurred. They think they don't ever really feel like they've left the military. And the other problem is they're putting more and more ex-military men into the civilian oversight of the Pentagon, and these guys are not, you know, when you retire from the military, you never retire.
Sure. Well, look, Dina, I think we've run out of time here, but I mean, it does, we've had these conversations before, in fact, going back decades, and it is just so amazing to think that we're even talking about cutting a military budget down to a size that would still make it higher than Cold War levels when we actually had a real level, a real enemy. So it's surreal discussion within a surreal discussion.
it's the Pentagon budget has doubled since 2001.
Again, I've been speaking with Dina Racer, who's the chief investigator of Follow the Money, of the Follow the Money project. She has for over 25 years, she has 20, over 25 years of experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud, and for 10 years directed the Washington, D.C. based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that she founded in its work with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and the defense industry exposing fraud and waste. She has a column at Truthout. Her latest one is Should Cost versus Did Cost, How the Military-Industrial Complex Swindles Billions of Our Dollars. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be talking with a UC Davis professor whose students were pepper sprayed.
This city is run by pigs. They take away the rights from all the kids. I walk down the street, flip them off. They hit me across the head with a billy club.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bob Ostertag, who's a professor of techno-cultural studies and music at the University of California at Davis, a composer, performer, historian, instrument builder, journalist, activist, and kayak instructor. Bob Ostertag has performed at music, film, and multimedia festivals around the globe with the Kronos Quartet, avant-garde musician John Zorn, heavy metal star Mike Patton, jazz great Anthony Braxton, punk rocker Lynn Breedlove, drag diva Justin Bond, and others. He is rumored to have connections to the shadowy media guerrilla group, the Yes Men. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bob Ostertag.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
And you teach at UC Davis, where I think just about everybody in the world has seen the viral video of the kind of Star Wars trooper-type policeman spraying pepper spray on huddled students as though he were watering the lawn in a kind of nonchalant way, and of course causing an excruciating pain to these students, these very stoical students. You know some of these students. What have they said to you subsequent to this?
Well, one thing that I would like people to know is just what the consequences of that much pepper spray are. That was shot at point-blank range into the face, and he walked back and forth. He covered them with about three separate layers of military-grade pepper spray. Some of those students are still not well. They're still in pain. Most of them are recovered by now, but they couldn't take a shower for a day or two because of the burning sensation. One of them has nerve damage in his hand. Pepper spray is a serious weapon, and it's people should know it's not like it stings for 30 minutes and then it goes away. It's hours and hours and sometimes days of truly excruciating pain. One student is an 18-year-old college freshman. He had arrived at college 8 weeks ago, and he's a top student. He's the most mild-mannered, self-effacing young man who would never draw attention to himself, very soft-spoken. All top students, I would say, for my students that were involved in this, they're at the top of the top, which stands to reason that the most civic-minded students would be the ones out there, because what they see themselves as doing is defending public education. As your listeners may know, just 5 years ago, tuition in the University of California system was $5,000 a year. It's now $12,000 a year, and it's about to go up to $22,000 a year. That's a jump from $5,000 to $22,000. Davis, you know, we're in the Central Valley. We have a lot of students from Fresno and Modesto and small farming towns. We have, by and large, a very humble working class student body here. And there is a significant number of them who will have to terminate their college education when tuition goes up to $22,000 a year. So the kids who are out there trying to find a way to voice their dissent are the really civic-minded students who take public education seriously. So, of course, they're the students with the highest grade point averages.
So, Bob Ostertag, at the time of the incident, I'm told that the students that were standing by as their friends were being pepper sprayed, they started to chant, shame on you, to the police. Is that right?
Oh, the full scene, your viewers, if they're interested, they should go to YouTube and type in UC Davis pepper spray. And one of the top things that will come back is a thing that a student just put up, where he took the cell phone videos from four different cell phones and synchronized them. So you see a screen that has a separate cell phone image in four different quadrants, but they're all synced up. So you can actually see the scene from four angles, and it will give you a better perspective on the scene than you have in the video that most people have seen around the world. And you will find that it's even more chilling when you understand the full context. This was a group of about 20 kids sitting on the grass with other people around them, and you'll see in the video that the police officer walks up to one of the students and tells him he's going to shoot him if he doesn't move. And the student looks at him incredulously and says, "You're going to shoot me for sitting here? Well, go ahead and shoot me." And the officer saunters back to the cluster of police and, you know, chews the fat for a minute with his fellow cops, and then saunters over and starts pepper spraying everybody. It's just extraordinary. And to give you an idea of the tone of our students here, I'm told that prior to being pepper sprayed, the students in their in their ultra-democratic manner that they have discussed amongst themselves within earshot of the police a motion to demand that the police leave the quad. And this was voted down as being too belligerent, and instead they passed a motion to ask the police to leave the quad. They thought demanding the police would leave the quad would be too belligerent. So that's the posture of these students.
So these are campus police, right? These are not brought in from various local areas?
They look like they were brought in from an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, but in fact they are University of California police. And, you know, they're visored and helmeted and body armored and assault rifles and pepper spray to deal with a handful of students sitting in the grass. And I would say that any university that sends, you know, people who look like they've just stepped off the set of a hardcore action movie to deal with a group of very well-behaved student protesters, you know, from the moment that policeman steps into the situation, it's already escalated way beyond where it should, no matter what the cop does. I mean, the only thing that the presence of those weapons accomplishes is create the danger that they might be used.
Again, I'm speaking with Bob Ostertag, who's Professor of Technocultural Studies and Music at the University of California, Davis. Now, the Chancellor has obviously been quite chastened by this event. The Chief of Police, who I assume ordered the police to remove these students. Initially, the Chancellor said that the encampment, the Occupy encampment, raised serious health and safety issues. Given the degree to which the brutality on the police has captured the headlines, that seems like a bit of a stretch. But now, she apparently, the Chancellor, is really sort of jumping through hoops to try and get behind this. And equally so, it seems like the students and others, the momentum is growing to have her step down. I believe the Chief of Police, has she step down temporarily, and what's the fate of the chancellor?
Two of the police officers involved and the chief of police are both on paid administrative leave right now, and I don't know what the future disposition of their employment will be. There are calls from all over the world and all over the campus for the chancellor to resign. She has said she won't resign. At 5 o'clock this afternoon, in just a couple of hours, she's holding an open town hall with the campus, and we'll see what she has to say. Myself, I don't fault her so much for the fact that this happened. I think she does hold some responsibility for the fact that it happened. But after it happened, the first day after it happened, she issued a letter to the campus community where she justifies it all. And the second day after it happened, she issued another letter. And both of these letters were really divorced from reality. And, you know, from the perspective of somebody who's here at the campus, what we've seen is that as long as the discussion was limited to us here at the campus, the position of the school administration was that this was okay and that this was appropriate. And it was only when the administration started fielding calls from the world beyond and began to get a notion that CNN and basically the whole world thought this was outrageous, did they, you know, reevaluate their position? But when it was just the students saying, "What the heck? You know, this was wrong. This was a crime." The administration was not responsive to that at all.
Apparently, though, the chancellor has said that she grew up in Greece, and as a student, the military junta crashed tanks through the gates of the university and arrested students. I think some of them were even killed. So how do you think her sense of solidarity with the students is working?
I don't think it's working very well. And I should say, I don't know her personally, and I'm sure she's a wonderful person, and I have no particular grudge against the chancellor. Her resignation has not been my focus. Now, it has been the focus of quite a number of other faculty, of a lot of alumni, and of an overwhelming majority of the students. I for one, can't see how she could effectively continue to carry out her duties as chancellor of the university. As for me personally, I am much more concerned about policy than who resigns. I would like to see the University of California police disarmed. Basically, you know, all the campuses of the University of California have this same RoboCop thing going on. And, you know, most private universities in our country have unarmed police. And if a situation ever presents itself on campus which requires weapons, they call for, you know, the city police to come in. And I think it is an important question to ask as to why it is that rich kids who can afford to go to private university get to go to campuses where the police walk around in slacks and sweatshirts, and working class kids who go to public school walk around campuses where the cops look like they're in an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I mean, that is the 99% versus the 1% right there, reflected in the mindset of these campus police forces. And it's so unnecessary.
Well, in terms of policy, though, is there any talk now of police policy being reviewed, given that the California Department of Corrections have rules where officers cannot pepper spray inmates? Whether, you know, and some of these inmates have histories of murder and mayhem, they can't pepper spray them only under circumstances that where there's immediate threat of violence. And if a prisoner is seated, they cannot use pepper spray. In any case of the use of pepper spray, there's always an inquiry and a review. Also, apparently, the California Department of Corrections doctors who participated in a recent review of the medical literature on pepper spray for the CDC conclude that the medical consequences of pepper spray are not entirely understood. Now, you started out saying that some of these students still have serious after effects.
Yes, there's one student in particular who had a terrible reaction, and this is known about pepper spray, that it affects people differently. We don't understand why, but we do know it does. It's just like a chili pepper. Some people tolerate it very well, and some people tolerate it very poorly and can have very extreme reactions, which is why, by the way, in the prison system, if prison guards go into a situation where they anticipate the use of pepper spray, they are required to have medical personnel on standby to wash the people who are sprayed down and give them immediate medical treatment. And there was nothing like that provided to these students. Nothing at all. Now, I should add, I'm not so focused on the chancellor's resignation as a lot of other people at my school, but the man who did this, the guy who nonchalantly walked up and down coating these students with not one, not two, but three layers of pepper spray, I think this guy should face criminal charges. That was not only inappropriate, that was a straight-up crime. And he should face the consequences of that. And the police chief, who justified this 2 days after the fact, she was saying, well, you know, we were making split-second decisions. Split-second decisions, it's very clear to anybody who sees that video that there were no split-second decisions involved in this. So I think the police chief needs to get out of police work and maybe go to Hollywood and star in the kind of action movie she seems to imagine herself in. And the guy who did this needs to face justice.
This comes, of course, in the context of other Occupy demonstrations that have been treated with tremendous overreactions and brute force by the police. An 84-year-old woman in Seattle was pepper sprayed, and a Marine veteran from Iraq, Scott Olson, got a fractured skull from a tear gas canister up in Oakland. Just in closing, obviously the militarization of police in the United States is a direct consequence of the reaction to 9/11 and the enormous amount of money that Homeland Security has and Sam frankly doesn't know what to do with, because Homeland Security doesn't know what their mission is. So they're just spending money willy-nilly. And I guess if you give all these policemen all these weapons and toys and stuff, they're going to use them.
Well, I think there's a confluence of a lot of different factors here, and one is that our police departments have been sold all this high-tech weaponry, and the people who market it, you know, claim that it's a benign alternative to guns and police batons and pepper spray. And, you know, in Oakland they were using concussion cannons, sonic cannons, flash bombs. These things are not benign. They are in no way benign. This is just a straight-up fallacy. I also think that there's a mindset in this country, as everyone knows, our country is going through a period of deep political polarization. We just had the budget panel fail in Washington because of political polarization. And a lot of the police, you know, they see this country is divided between a red team and a blue team, and they think they're on the red team and the protesters are on the blue team, and, you know, this is their chance to go out and crack heads of the blue team.
Well, Bob Ostertag, I thank you for joining us and filling us in on what's happening on your campus.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss such an important issue.
Again, I've been speaking with Bob Ostertag. He's professor of technocultural studies and music at the University of California at Davis, a composer, performer, historian, instrument builder, journalist, activist, and kayak instructor. Bob Ostertag has performed at music, film, and multimedia festivals around the world with the Kronos Quartet, avant-garde musician John Zorn, heavy metal star Mike Patton, jazz great Anthony Braxton, punk rocker Lynn Breedlove, drag diva Justin Bond, and others. He is rumored to have connections to the shadowy media guerrilla group, the Yes Men. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about this sequestration or trigger that's been pulled to cut $1.2 trillion out of the federal budget across the board. A lot of people think it's never going to happen, that they've got a whole year to weasel their way out of it, the Congress. On the other hand, the president did offer a veto threat if they tried to weasel out of it. So some progressives think it could be a victory, given that the Pentagon takes the hit and not Social Security and Medicare. But Nicole Wu, who we had on first, Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, pointed out that they're asking for another $600 billion in cuts out of discretionary spending on top of a recent cut of $900 billion. So there's not a lot of blood left in that stone. So maybe there isn't that much to cheer about. In the second interview, I tried to get a kind of handle on whether this is real or not, because it just doesn't feel that real, even though the president has issued a veto threat. But that would seem to me logical, because that's the leverage that he has. Why would he give that up? I talked with Dina Racer, who I've talked to over the decades, Pentagon watchdog, been running operations involving whistleblowers inside the Pentagon. And she was equally puzzled as to why, on the one hand, the president would threaten to veto any attempts to get around the automatic cuts. On the other hand, his Secretary of Defense is screaming foul and saying the sky is falling, as, of course, are all defense hawks. She pointed out the absurdity of this, how incredibly high the defense budget is. I mean, it's ludicrously high. And even if they cut it back with the $400 billion that Panetta's been talking about earlier, which of course is all smoke and mirrors, because it's largely the money of getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, then the extra $900 billion on top of that, we'd still be back to 2007 levels. So clearly the defense spending is completely out of hand. And, you know, not that that's any news, but so we'll see. I'm quite puzzled as to whether this thing is actually real or not. Then finally, I spoke with Bob Ostertag, a professor of techno-cultural studies and music at UC Davis. Some of his students were pepper sprayed. He told me about how many of them are still having after effects, and that, curiously enough, the California Department of Corrections, the prison system, has restrictions on its use. It requires medical doctors present. Inmates are not sprayed, particularly if they're sitting down. Then these things are reviewed. So it seems like campus police, who all look like extras in some Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, are able to beat up on students more than prison guards on inmates. He was actually pointing out that, you know, on a lot of private universities like Columbia, et cetera, the police don't even have weapons, and they walk around in casual clothes. So there is something happening here. It's known as Homeland Security. Endless amounts of money being given to police departments for toys and Darth Vader costumes, and that's what's driving this insanity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.